Well, everyone smoked at their office and the tea lady came around and we all went out for lunch and that sort of thing. I mean, things that aren't heard of anymore.
And it changed the culture because instead of spending most of my day trying to sort of separate men that wanted to fight with each other almost, all of a sudden we were trying to work out solutions together.
Well, you virtually had to wait till someone died or someone left. People were leaving all the time. It was just too physical. It was really, really physical job.
So many memories and so much change. Hey, it's Penny Terry here, and this is the second episode of Hotspots. This season is all about the 70th anniversary of the aluminium smelter at Bell Bay, and there has been a lot of change. And the stories that can really help us understand how much are those from the people who've spent the majority of their working lives, in some cases all of it, working at that site.
We were part of, I think, the world first in a whole range of things.
And on this episode, we'll hear about four of them. Four things that we see or use almost every day that got their start out at Bell Bay.
People panicked and they'd just take off and it'd just come down on them like rain. Like, you had no helmets enough in them days and you had cotton, you know, work clothes and it just burned holes straight through. Just like little marbles running down your skin.
We are in for a pretty visual reminder of how much safety has changed, which came up a lot. As did the picnics. I've heard so much about the picnics.
Picnics. Oh, they were fantastic, the picnics. We used to have them years ago at the beaches.
Everybody's got a story about the picnics in Georgetown. And Georgetown was my first stop as I went about collecting stories from some of the longer-serving employees.
Hello, Heather.
Yes.
I'm Penny. How are you?
Thank you.
This is Heather Ashley. Heather is now a councillor on the Georgetown Council, but she spent 22 years at that smelter and she had a bit of a hard time leaving.
After I retired, I was asked to go back to Rio and do a maternity leave for one of the girls in the pot rooms. And I went back and it was only supposed to be 12 months maternity leave, and I finished it up 2.5 years later leaving again.
You can't keep away. It's just part of life for you.
Yeah, it was part of life, part of my life. It was a good part of my life. And so I was only home, I reckon, 9 months, and then I went to work at the chemist shop.
Well, what's it like when you have been working for the one company for such a long time and then you wake up on that first morning and go, right, what do I do now?
It's very strange. I'll never forget that. It was like, oh, my God, I don't have to get up. I don't have to go to work today. I never have to wear that uniform again. And it's like surreal. It's like you're in a dream. And for about the first 3 weeks I was like that. It was like, oh, I'll probably have to go back to work tomorrow, you know, like.
Do you still have the uniform?
Probably got a jumper or something in my walking robe. yeah.
If we can jump back, tell me when you started at, I think it's probably Comalco when you first started there.
Definitely Comalco when I started. I started in the late 80s and I went in to do 2 weeks temp and 22 years later walked out.
What do you remember about that first day?
Oh, I was scared, you know, really scared. I mean, I'd done a lot of other jobs in my time, but it was a different, it was a receptionist job in the front of the admin building at the time, because in those days when you walked into the admin building, you spoke to the receptionist before you went anywhere and she rang you forward and let people know you were arriving. There was a lot more etiquette involved in that time. And it was sort of the handshake of the company. It was lovely. And when I was there, they were still using typewriters and they had tic-tac machines and...
What's a tic-tac machine?
Oh, it's a machine where it was sort of like a message machine that a messages came through on and then you had to read all the messages out on it and everything. Then computers came in and there was certain elite people that got to use computers.
So. Elite people, was that you?
No, it was more like the GM's PA and all the but later on, of course, you teach yourself these things and you don't realise. You say, oh, I'm too old to do this now, but you're not. You're never too old. You're never too old to teach yourself and learn.
When you started there in the late 80s, what was it like when you would enter the smelter? Because I'd imagine it's a bit different.
When you walked into the smelter, there was a great big reception desk, and you sat behind that in your country road uniform with your pearls on and your hair done and perfume and everything just perfect, you know, and very different time from now. You know, the change from the country road to the one status workforce was a bit hard for the women that had worked in the country road for a lot of years, you know.
Tell me about that. What do you remember?
Well, I remember we used to have beautiful pleated skirts, lovely white shirt and a vest. And then we went to the Yakka. It was all blue in the beginning, the Yakka work trousers and work top. And over the years, it's just progressed into the colours as well. So, and I remember still trying to tart mine up a bit with pearls and when you think back, you know, it didn't do too bad for a Yakka shirt.
Did you have to, do you remember, did you go to a fitting and then you're just putting on what would have felt like a very different uniform?
When we wore the other uniforms, we had them all fitted and people would come down, they'd bring their uniforms down, they'd fit them, everything. But once when we went into the Yakka, you just went, oh, yeah, I'm a 12. They had women's 12s, women's 14s, women's 16s and so on in shirts. And you just went into SAP and ordered yourself what you needed.
So what did you call the policy that changed?
It was called one status workforce, so which meant men and women were all equal. And that's one of the things that I did notice over my years with Rio was the fact that I seen women come through the team and become part of the management team, where when I first started at Rio, there weren't many women in the management team. They were all men. It was a very, well, everyone smoked at their office and the tea lady came around and we all went out from time to time for a lunch and that sort of thing. I mean, things that aren't heard of anymore, but that's what happened in the 70s and 80s, you know, that's just was life, you know.
We often talk about or hear in workplaces that change is constant, and it sounds like you've dealt with that a fair bit. What do you remember about these changes happening and how they were rolled out and whether they were embraced or whether there was a little bit of pushback? How did it play out?
I think with people that had worked at the smelter for a lot of years, there was a little bit of every time there was a change, it was like, oh, here we go again. And then there were people like myself that embraced change, thought that every time we had a change, it was something good for the smelters. And usually it was, but on my time at Rio, at Comalco, it gave my family a very good life, brought my children up, they went to uni, all of those sort of things. I don't know whether we would have been able to afford that had I not got the opportunity of working in a company like that. And I worked with some amazing people. I learnt from so many amazing people.
Is there anyone you want to shout out, or will we miss people off the list? Is that a bit of a danger zone?
I don't know. I think somebody that I really respected and worked with was Ray McSorgall. Ray was very, very, very good to work for. And John Lemberg, Bob Harkness, very good to work for. Michael Parks, all people that I were PAs to and learnt a lot from, you know.
Well, let's rewind a little bit because you're talking about being a PA here, but when we started the conversation, you started on the reception desk. Your 2 weeks was up. What happened from there?
Oh, then I just stayed on the reception desk. They said, would you like me to us to renew your contract? And it went on and on and on. And I don't think I was, as I say, about 18 months before I actually applied for a role as a PA to Michael Parks when he was in personnel at the time, and I got that role. And that started the ball rolling then with PAs. I just went from one manager would leave, another one would come in, or else another job would come up in another area and you'd say, oh, I might apply for that one, and you'd get that one. And eventually I just went through everything that was there. I finished up working for the GM for a while. So, you know, it was like I'd gone right up the tree. Yeah.
And how did the role of a PA change in that time?
Oh, heavens, it changed a lot, because in the beginning you were taking notes and you were doing everything for the person that you work for.
What do you mean by everything?
Well, you were like booking appointments, booking travel, typing out all his notes, drawing up flow charts for him, doing packages, all sorts of things. But as time went by, a lot of those managers decided that they could do a lot of that themselves. So the role became a little bit less of doing that sort of thing. And then you progressed into roles of becoming an auditor for like safety, or did other roles that were out there, or down onto the floor. And I can remember walking through the potlines when I was working in the potlines, and I was thinking, oh, this is such a scary place, you know. And then you find out that women are actually going to be starting on the potlines in 3 weeks, you know, and you go, oh, my Lord, you know, like those poor girls. But they loved it, and now it's such a one-status workforce, and there's so many women working. I mean, it was a very select few women working at Comalco when I was there, and they were all maybe PAs or worked in the typing pool or, you know, not out on the floor. But once we got out on the floor, I tell you, I think we surprised the men what we could do. But it was the world progressing all the time. And if you didn't move along with that progression, well, you stagnated.
22 years, so many changes. There must have been some big events or stories or points that you remember. What are some of the big things you remember from your time?
We had a great big open day at Comalco, and we bussed all these people in, and we showed them, we did all the history of Comalco. People came up and spoke to you, and you talked about your areas, and they had photos taken of all the people that were working there, and they were all in the canteen and in what we used to call the visitor centre. And it was just a really interesting day, and it was really great to see so many of the community want to come in and have a look, and because it was a place that people weren't actively invited in to have a look around, you know. So it was a real curiosity show, you know, for a lot of people, because they were like, oh, wow, I didn't know that this happened here, and I didn't know that happened there. And it was just so many different things. Another thing that was really sticks in my mind was when they decided that they banned smoking. Everybody smoked in their office. You just went upstairs. It was just like a haze, you know, like every, and then all of a sudden this, you weren't allowed to smoke. And
so how did that rollout work? Was it one day, no more smoking? Therefore, was everyone going outside to have cigarette breaks?
It was, on this day, it's going to be a smoke-free workforce. And we were like, and if you wanted to smoke, they had designated areas that you could go outside and smoke in, but you weren't allowed to smoke around the doors or anywhere like that. So you'd see these people all going out, you'd know where they were going, and they were coming back again and going out again. But I noticed a lot of people stopped smoking. So, I mean, it was good, but it was difficult for a lot too.
We've been talking so much, you haven't even had a sip of your coffee, Heather. Would you like a sip of your coffee? I love that you've made a whole list here, Heather, of things that we can talk about. What else has come up for you as the big changes?
I think a really big thing was respect. In the first, when we first started it, when I first started at Rio, there was a bit of a, like, the white collar and the blue collar. But as we went into a one-status workforce, it started to change, and you could see people becoming more accountable for other people's feelings and how they felt, and sharing a little bit more information with people and things like that. And I think they were teaching people to respect each other and have time for each other, and not to think that anyone was better than anyone else, because at that time we were all transitioning into a one workplace.
How do you teach that? How do you make that happen in a place as big as the smelter?
They used to have a stop work meeting every morning. The manager would come down and he'd speak to all the superintendents and the crew leaders, relate what had gone on in meetings, managers' meetings, things like that, pass that information on so it could flow to the process workers or the people that were on the floor, or we had maintenance people. Another great big thing I've seen was women move into maintenance and become electricians and tradesmen.
Tradespeople.
Tradespeople, yeah. I think, too, it was very family orientated.
Talking about being family oriented, what do you remember about the picnics? I've heard so much about the picnics.
Oh, they were fantastic, the picnics. We used to have them years ago at the beaches, and we'd have the sandcastles competitions and the ginger beer and the giveaways, and it was amazing. They were lovely. They were beautiful. The families all got together, and sometimes it was the only time you got to meet guys that you work with or women that you work with, husbands or their wives and their children. So it was lovely. And then as the years went on, you've seen these children become adults. And some of these children that were at some of the picnics when I first started at Kamalco at the time, you know, I see their kids grow up and become apprentices. And so it was a total family type thing. And I mean, I know of people that have four or five people in their family working at Rio.
It's incredible. There aren't many people these days that stay in the one place for the one, working for the one organisation as long as you have. What do you think kept you there?
I just love where I live and I just felt safe, felt I could do my job. I felt safe in my job. They were very good to me. Over the years, they'd been very good to me. If I ever had a child sick or anything that needed help, I always got support from my managers or from the management team. And it just kept me there. It just kept me, I just loved it. I loved my job.
This podcast is about celebrating the 70th anniversary. What's your message to anyone who might be listening to this? So it could be community, it could be somebody who works for Rio somewhere else in Australia or on the other side of the world. It could be employees, past, present, potential. What's the message from you?
I want to say happy birthday, Rio, and thank you for 70 years of supporting, giving and loving our community. It's been a privilege to have had time with you and have worked with you all.
The look on your face, it was like you're genuinely talking to this organisation.
Yeah, well, that's how I feel. You know, I just want people to understand that I have a daughter that works at Rio in Western Australia, so it's a wonderful place to work. If you're good to Rio, Rio's good to you.
Heather, thank you so much for sharing your memories with us today.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to them.
Heather Ashley, and a memory full of stories of her 22 years working at Bell Bay. And there are still plenty more stories to collect, so it was back in the car for me and off to visit...
Jeff, right. G'day. I'm Penny. Lovely to meet you.
So how's retirement going?
Yeah, all right.
This is Jeff Baker, and Jeff was very fresh into retirement when I met him. How many days is it since you retired now, Jeff?
It'd be 3 weeks, I reckon.
That's not very long.
No.
How are you going?
Going all right. Yep, going all right.
I saw a photo of you holding a trophy with a number one on it. There it is on the wall. Tell me about it. What is this?
I got to the longest serving. So this bloke's been there 50, 51. I've been there 47 and a half years.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, not bad.
So can you do the maths for me? When did you start, Jeff?
77, 10th. 10th month of 77.
And what do you remember about those early days, or maybe your first day?
Yeah, the first day I got there, I went to crib room, first crib. No, I didn't know you. Everyone had a certain seat. So I sits down this seat, I didn't know. I'm eating away and this little bloke come in. They called him Dutchie. And he's looking at me. I said, oh, g'day, mate. And he's looking. Next minute he sits down on the floor beside me and started eating his crib. Everyone started laughing and they told me so. I moved.
How long did it take you to get your own seat, Jeff?
Oh, it took a while.
Yeah, what happens?
What happens is they used to play cards, drafts and chess in the crib room them days, and as one left you, you kind of moved up a seat. Mm-hmm. Then you got to play cards.
How far up did you get in those seats?
Oh, number one. Number one.
How many years does that take?
Oh, I don't know, about five, I reckon, five or six. Yeah.
So how old were you when you started and what did you go in doing?
I was 18, started 18, just an ingot operator, stacking ingots next 5 years.
For people who don't know, what's an ingot?
They weigh about 25 kilo, red hot, and they remelt them in little smelters and that to make different alloys, but it's not a good job.
You say that, but you went for the job when you were 18. Tell me about that and that decision at the time.
Yeah, I was 18. I was just about to get married. I was working at Sims Metals. I started there after school. I was getting married and Dad said, oh, I don't know about the money. He said, why don't you go to Kamalco? I'll ring your Uncle Fred up and see if he gets you a job. And I said, yep, all right. So he rang Fred up and had a
interview on the Wednesday in the medical, and I started on the Monday. My last pay at Sims Medicals was $64. My first pay at Rio, Comalco, was $172, so the money was good.
Hit the jackpot.
Yeah.
So you said it was a rubbish job, stacking the ingots. What happened from there? Like, tell me about your progression through.
Well, you virtually had to wait till someone died or someone left. Nah. people were leaving all the time. It was just too physical. It was really, really physical job. And I don't reckon at 50 you could have done it. It was that physical, because 18 in your 20s, you're at your peak. So I just stacked ingots, waited my time, and I got a relief job at DC1. They used to cast billets. They're round aluminium. They call them billets, and used to use them for power lines and everything else. And we made a lot of them days. And I relieved there for a while, and then someone left, and I got his job, put in for it, and got the job. Same days, you had classifications. You had an ingot classification, that was the lowest, and then you had a furnaceman. And DC, that was the main one. If you got one of them, it was home in those then. You could get a, like, relief crew leader or scheduler or something like that.
When you started, was there any intention to stay for, what was it, 42 years?
47.
Sorry, 47 years.
What happened? I started and I hated it with a passion. And my brother was a temp guy. He said, come over after 2 weeks. He said, come over here. He said, I'll see my boss, see if he get a job. I said, all right. So I went to temp guy and spoke to him and all that. And they said, nah, we'll give you a job. And I said, the money. And it was $25 difference at the time. That was my rent. So I decided to start Comalco.
And so 47 years later, what was the job that you've just retired from? What was the role?
I was in called the mould shop. We refurbish all the casting moulds, the cast aluminium through. A lot of different work. It was good. I liked it.
So 47 years is a really long time, and I'm wondering about some of the changes or some of the big moments that you remember, Jeff, funny, serious, life-changing from the time that you've been at Bell Bay Aluminium.
I've got a couple of little funny stories. We had two crew leaders. These boxes, we used to heat them up, put them in the crane bay, and we'd heat them up with a gas torch. We'd just leave it, and now these days you're supposed to be there all the time with the gas torch in case it goes out. Them days you didn't. You'd have it all covered up and the thing be heating away, and was there DC4, and his bloke said, yeah, you're these two. These two crew leaders come up, and it had gone out. Well, they lifted up and they're looking in it, not going, one's one end, one's the other. Well, one bloke down the other end, he got a cigarette lighter out, and he went like that. She went, woof, the poor bugger up the other end, burned all his beard off. He had no eyebrows, all his hair was singed. He came back to work about 5 days later, like he had fish scales all over his face. Not lucky, because it just goes, it's like a little bomb, it goes boom, you get flames everywhere.
How quick do you learn, I don't know, is it insider knowledge? I mean, how quick did you have to learn this stuff on the job when you're, you know, an 18-year-old?
Oh, pretty quick. They were good blokes, they showed you and they told you. Them old blokes, they'd been there years and years. Don't do that, boy. Come on, boy, don't do that. Do it this way. It's easier on your back. They just taught you. If you did something wrong, they'd let you know it too. They'd call you some names.
Well, maybe that brings up one of the things that must have changed a lot when you were there around safety. And Jeff, look at you like, oh, I don't know if I should tell that story.
Safety's, there was virtually none really. Yeah, pretty horrendous when you think about it. Pretty dangerous. Always an explosion every day. Every day there was a, especially on ingots, they'd blow up.
Wait, what does that mean? When an ingot's blowing up, what's happening around you where you are?
When they start to go into the mould, the mould's wet or cold, as soon as the aluminium hits it, it reacts and it will just explode. And you was under this little, that roof and the front, that's all it had. You used to skim the ingots, skim the dross off the ingots, go in, you'd skim it. If they turn the water on too soon, it would come round and that mould would be wet. And as soon as it hit it, you might have 5 or 6 ingots. Just go boom, boom. But they always told you to stay under there because it would go up and it would come down to stay on the roof. But people panicked and they'd just take off and it would just come down on them like rain. Like you had no helmets and nothing in them days and you had cotton, you know, work clothes and it just burned holes straight through. Just like little marbles running down your skin. That would happen every day.
Do you ever get got?
Yeah, I got a few here and
just showing me the scars.
Yeah, one here. Yeah, I got a few. Just from burns.
Close calls for you, Jeff. Were there many?
No, not really. No. But I've seen a couple of bad, really, really bad ones. Where people just one bloke, the shirt was just off him. All his skin was, yeah, it was pretty horrific. And in them days, they never had showers around. Like, they got safety showers everywhere now. All they had was these blankets. And we wrapped him up in the blanket and they called the ambulance and that, and they come and took him away. Yeah.
When you reflect on the changes in safety, what do you think about and how's that been for you as someone who's working and having to learn?
The way you do things now, that's the safety's in that, because you do nearly everything with the machine now. Everything, when we done it, was all by hand. You threw your scrap in by hand, so you was virtually on right beside the furnace door, and if it blew up, it'd come back out at you or splash out at you. But you don't do none of that no more. It's all done with a forklift virtually.
What does it mean for the people who work there, apart from the obvious?
That's, you know, they've never ever seen anything blow up before.
So what does that mean for the role of someone like you who has been there long enough to remember these accidents? And I wonder how you share that with your teams.
You try and tell some of them, they just look at you and don't believe you half the time. But, it's come a long way, safety. That's probably the biggest improvement.
Again, such a long time there. It must be a huge part of your life. That smelter and the people there and the way of life of shift work?
It was me life. That's all I knew. 8-hour shifts are the worst. I've done them for 20-odd years, first 20-odd years, and you got one weekend off a month. And if you had kids, like I had 3 children, if it wasn't for your wife, it wouldn't work. They had to be mother and father. They'd take them to their sport, take them to school. Afternoon shift, if you'd done a double on the weekend, you wouldn't see the kids for 7 days because they'd go to school, you'd be in bed because you never got home to midnight. And then they come home from school, you're going to work at 3 o'clock. It was shocking then. They were shocking things, them shifts.
When did they change and what do you remember about that?
I think they changed in 1998, I think we changed. I can't remember. Went to 12-hour shifts. It was a lot better. A lot better. You had 14 days a month. You had every second weekend off. But by then, all my kids had grown up, so I had to spend time with the wife.
What a bonus. What about the people and your workmates, I guess, and what they've meant as part of your life for 47 years, well, and into the future?
I got some. You probably have 4 or 5 real good mates out there. You know, there's probably 30. You know everyone, but the real good ones. But I'll have them. They'll be my friends for life. Good blokes. It's funny. You learn to love them. You know, cause you spend that much time with them. You know all about their families. And we used to do a lot too in the older days. We'd have family days, go and have a game of cricket. All the kids would come, eat ice cream, cordials and lollies and all that. And kids would all play together and women would sit around talking and that, and folks be having a few beers and a game of cricket and football. We used to do it all the time. It's really, really good.
Sounds like pretty precious memories.
Oh, yeah, they were. Oh, they are, yeah. From when I started now, from the day I started, I think there's only about 5 people probably still alive. You know, they're all passed away. I was telling Katie, my bossy, the other week, it was Anzac Day, I was watching the granddaughter march. I'm standing there and I'm looking, this bloke's looking at me and I'm looking at him, little fella. I thought, geez, I know him. I thought, Possum Neil. And I went over, I said, Possum, Jeffrey Baker, he said.
I hadn't seen him for 44 years. He'd left 44 years and we worked together for, what, 4 years? And I still knew who he was and he still knew who I was. Mm. And he'd been living in Darwin, I think he told me.
What kept you there so long, Jeff? I'm literally outliving your workmates.
I got to enjoy the job I was doing, the mould maintenance and that. I liked that. It was, you had, you know, 4 or 5 different things you had to do. It just wasn't the one. You wasn't on ingots, stacking ingots all day. You just moved around. You could talk to everyone, maintenance. I worked with them, contractors. It was a real, real good job. But that and, of course, well, in the finish, it didn't matter about the money, but the money's, you know, you're not going to go and get straight out of high school and get money like that. No one does these days. Got to do a lot of overtime to do that, but you work there, you don't have to.
Any other particular memorable moments, Jeff, that you might share with people? They could be people from Rio, around Australia, around the world, or just community members listening to this. Any other moments?
Liz Wayne, she was a big part of me out there. I got there, that enough, and I went in one day and I went and seen the manager. I said, I'm finishing up, I've had enough. I'm not doing these nights just no more, mate. He said, oh, you can't. I said, no, I've had enough. He said, Liz was in Queensland then at the smelter up there, and he said, she'll be back next week. He said, just wait till next week and we'll have a talk to her.
What did Liz do?
She was a superintendent. And I went home, and about 2 hours later, the phone rang and it was Liz. She said, come and work with me in the mould shop. I'll put you in the mould shop with Dick, Richard Howe. We'd been here for years, old Richard, good bloke. And I said, just give it a month, 2 months. If you don't like it, don't leave. I said, all right, I'll do that. And I stayed there stayed there to the end. But she was really respected her. She was a good person. Got me buggered out. She never ever become GM. She worked everywhere around, she pot lines everywhere she worked, and she treated you real good too.
You've got the trophy, the number one. I think you also know who you're handing it on to perhaps later, or have you already handed it on?
I handed it on. Shortest lived one ever, they said.
Bugger.
I think it was a week and a half.
That feels unfair after 47 years.
Well, at least I got it.
And so what's it been like in the last 3 weeks waking up? You live in Launceston and not getting in the car and going down the highway.
I found it hard. But beyond, I've been off work for the last nearly a year now. I had 3 operations on my shoulder, new shouldering, nothing worked. I'll get used to it, I think. I didn't think I would, but I will. Yeah.
How important is that place to your life? How important has it been?
Oh, it's been everything. Yeah. Apart from my family, that's second to me. People laugh at me, but I don't care.
Family comes second.
No, family comes first.
Oh, well, I was going to say, wow.
Family comes first, then that place, they just, people look at me. How can you like the place like that? But no, read me family. I've been on holidays, own me house. You know, so it's been pretty good to me. I've been sick a few times and they've looked after me real, real good. So I can't complain about nothing.
Jeff, it's been really nice speaking with you. Thank you.
No, thank you very much.
Jeff Baker. And I reckon I only scratched the surface of the stories that Jeff could tell. But it was time for me to go searching in another person's memory for more stories. And I found my next guest, who Jeff actually mentioned, on holidays in Queensland.
We've got a beautiful view out onto the water. It's a bit stormy today, but
whereabouts in Queensland are you at the moment?
We're all about.
This is Liz Swain. I caught up with Liz over a Zoom call. Liz holds the record for the longest-serving female employee at the smelter, and we started where it all began.
It was a really interesting experience because I'd applied for a job that said young men interested in careers in engineering and accounting and chemistry, please apply. So I applied, and they said it was the first time they'd actually ever had a female apply. So a while later, when I was on my first day of employment, I found out that they employed 7 that year rather than normal 6 to see how long the token female would last, which was fairly interesting because I did. But on my first day, I and my six friends, and they are still friends now, wandered in sort of looking pretty lost, I think, and we signed off on our contracts on a carbon copy. I don't know if you remember the old typing where you had to carbon copy everything, and that went pretty well. And then the next morning I turned up and they said, look, Liz, that contract you signed isn't valid because you're a female and you can only earn 75% of the male's wages. And I remember thinking, oh, that's a bit tough. And I just said, don't we have a valid contract? And they said, well, actually you do, but you know, we don't have to pay you that amount. And I said, well, do I really have to re-sign? And in the end, I managed to retain my 100% of the same rate that the guys were earning as well. And it was like $15 a week, so we weren't talking a lot of money.
But it was probably a lot of money back then. I wonder how aware you were of the stance you were taking in that moment, Liz, or if it just came out of your mouth.
A combination, I think. I just remember thinking that doesn't sound terribly fair because I knew there would be a few trials and tribulations ahead of me.
When you saw the ad advertised for young men, why did you look at it? Why did you apply?
My brother's a civil engineer and I thought, you know, he's 3.5 years older than I am. He hadn't finished his training, but he was well on the way. And I remember thinking, I can do that. I was a maths and science graduate at high school and going on to matric. And it didn't seem like a barrier, but at the time, when I think about it later, it certainly was. And, you know, no one else applied, so...
You got the job. And stepping into that role, I guess the first woman, was it outside admin to be employed on site?
Yes, yeah, so I worked in a lab in my first year and it was a fairly interesting experience because in a lab there's a combination of a lot of people that are either highly qualified or just sort of supporting those that are highly qualified. And one of the worst experiences of my life, I think, was my boss dragged me in his office and grabbed me and sat me on his knee and groped me and said, you know, Liz, you'll do anything for me, won't you? And I went, I was horrified. I came from a private girls' school and I really wasn't up to understanding the ways of the world. I was 18, I reckon. And I leapt up and ran out of the office. And half an hour later, I was back in the office with him and his boss. And his boss just said, Liz, you're on a first and final warning. And this is in my first year of working in industry. And I said, well, do you want to hear what happened? He said, no, not at all, but you refused duty and this is your written warning. And it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me because I suddenly realised this is not going to be easy. This is not going to work out fairly in some ways. But it also made me very wary of getting in compromising situations that I couldn't get out of. So contrasting that to 50 years on, all the young graduates that were coming in that were female, I was luckily enough to be able to first of all help select them and secondly mentor as many as I was allowed to. And that was a wonderful experience because whatever their problems were, I'd kind of had some sort of understanding of what can go wrong and all those sort of things. And it was wonderful to be able to diffuse, I guess, quite a lot of those issues that they were so concerned about that didn't sound too bad to me, but I also understood, you know, 50 years of change is a lot of change to come through. And I think we've been in a really fortunate position to just be able to be involved in those changes and probably one of the best times ever. You know, the technology's come through, the people have come through, and now it's just normal to be part of a team where there might be an imbalance of male or female, and it can be either way. But it's normal rather than, you know, striving to not put a foot wrong, having to be almost better than everybody else.
I mean, that's a huge experience in your first year, and hearing about the change that you were able to bring and be part of is huge. But I wonder how aware you were that you were the first and what that brought, whether it was pressure or whether it was pride or something else entirely.
Probably a combination of those things. I also had a bit of family resistance because my mother thought I should, or my parents really thought I should go to uni and be a doctor or a lawyer, and was fairly horrified that I'd pick this option. So you sort of have the old cultural pressure of what is the right thing to do versus also the, I suppose, wanting to succeed, wanting to be successful in an environment that was completely foreign but also fascinatingly interesting. And when I graduated as a metallurgist, I was moved into the research department, and that was an absolutely fantastic time. We were part of, I think, the world first in a whole range of things, including making the first aluminium foil. It was called Comalco Alfoil, which is, you know, pretty common in the kitchen everywhere these days, although Comalco no longer make it. We developed the two-piece aluminium can. This is all done in a lab, you know, the pre-work. And I was part of the group to be involved, although a very junior part, to develop the two-piece aluminium can that replaced the three-piece steel can.
Tell me more about that, because people now will be picturing what maybe a Coke can. Like, tell me what you mean by two-piece aluminium can rather than the other type.
Well, the aluminium can, well, every can you see today, I'm thinking, are all aluminium cans. Probably the only ones would be maybe some fruit that's still in the little steel can. The steel can, the three-piece can, it's got a solid bottom, a solid top, and a tunnel central part. With the aluminium can, it was drawn sort of through, so squeezed out might be a better way, extruded might be a more understanding terminology. So the base was one alloy, the top, and still is, a different alloy, because you have to be able to have the zip top on the top. So we developed both those alloys to work in that environment and basically took over the world. You know, it goes on. We developed the aluminium alloy wheel, which replaced the steel wheel and the more commonly turn wheel, the mag wheel, magnesium wheel. We developed that because aluminium's a lot more forgiving than magnesium, as it's pretty brittle, and steel that rusts. So we got into that market. And then the final one, which I think is probably the crown of the whole lot, was we developed zinc alloy. So before that, all steel was galvanized when it was in an outdoor environment. And with zinc alloy, that was a mixture, a combination of aluminium and zinc in the coating. That created a complete change. For a start off with, galvanizing had about somewhere between a 15 and 30 year life, whereas zinc alum's sort of still going. And right now, when you see Colorbond everywhere in the world, that's basically steel with a zinc alum coating and then the colored facade that we all know to love. And they were all developed by us in the very early days of my time at Comalco in Bell Bay. And then later on, I was so privileged because I was running the cast house in terms of the casting of those alloys. So you move from the development of them and the research of them into the production of them. And even beyond that, occasionally I'd be sent to a customer where we were supplying the products in to help identify a problem or work with them to get a better solution or something like that. So to come from a research environment to a production environment to a customer base was a pretty fantastic opportunity for me and for a lot of other metallurgists too.
You can't go outside. You can't live without seeing a product, whether it's wheels, roofs or cans, that you've had a part, and many people at that plant at Bell Bay have had a part in developing. That's incredible, Liz.
I think it's incredible it's not really recognised.
Yeah.
You know, as I said, I was a very junior person, so please don't misinterpret it.
Take it.
The research people that were there at the time and the wonderful opportunities that occurred there were just fantastic. You know, and as I said, we're a little Bell Bay, probably leading the world. As far as in my world, we were certainly leading the world, and I don't think there was anyone else. And we certainly had patents on some of those things, so we must have been doing pretty well.
Yeah. What helped you find your place in this workplace over the years?
I think having several mentors, and let me put the negative to that. You know, I'd go in the workplace and someone would say, you know, you're taking a job away from my son, you shouldn't be here, and women shouldn't be in industry, and a whole range of those sort of negative comments. But along with that, I had some fantastic mentors. They were normally my bosses who sort of saw that I could make a difference. I realised very early on that I couldn't just be one of the boys. I had to be someone else. And the someone else that I worked out that worked for me was to try and listen to the guys that had a grievance or had a concern and try and work with them to come up with a solution. And that had come from a different environment. We were originally developed by British Aluminium, and it was a very hierarchical society where the boss was the only person and he knew, and you don't listen to anybody, you do what I say. And that was a culture that was changing, and I was lucky to be part of the culture to help change it to a more inclusive environment where your team was the strongest part of your work, and team solutions worked. And so I spent a lot of time being transferred around the site to places that weren't very cohesive to try and come up with an improved team environment and really to bring about cultural change. And probably one of my most exciting environments was I went into a maintenance section, which was pretty unaccepted by the tradespeople and the apprentices. They'd always had a boss that was, you know, the best tradesman, really, you know, the person that knew all the solutions. I didn't have any of those. And that was a pretty hard time. But over time, that and the production department that I did have some experience with because of my metallurgy sort of background, Rio Tinto decided it wanted all staff contracts to go away from the 15 unions that we had running on our site. And they selected our site in Australia to be the first site to run with this. And we turned our team around to all staff contracts in about 30 days. When I say it turned around, about 95% of them, not everybody signed up initially, but that was a first for the site. It was a first for Rio Tinto, and it changed the culture because instead of having 15 unions all trying to fight with each other and trying to make a name for themselves and spending most of my day trying to sort of separate men that wanted to fight with each other almost, all of a sudden we were trying to work out solutions together and trying to work as a cohesive team. And it wasn't smooth sailing, but it was a hell of a lot better workplace environment than the one before.
Was there a particular turning point, maybe it was the staff contracts, for you when you began to be treated differently or seen differently?
There would have been still people when I left that thought I shouldn't be there, I suspect. I think one of the turning points, which is a completely furphy really, was that we started using a system called SAP. And SAP meant that you had to be able to log in on a computer and you had to be able to, for example, request a time off or put in a work request for maintenance or I'm just trying to think, request some equipment that needed to be bought. And some people never made it because they didn't have the literacy and numeracy to get there. So there were a group of people that got left behind at that stage, and maybe that helped the cultural change a little bit, which is a bit sad, but, you know, that's what happens when you move forward. Because the people that did leave, and there were quite a few that just couldn't handle the sort of change that was necessary, were probably some of the people who were never going to change. So if you want change to happen, to sometimes you have to move people on.
Maybe with that in mind, what moments, I guess, tested you most over your time? Are there any that come to mind? Any more, maybe I should say.
There are a lot of moments. I was frequently challenged about my ability or knowledge or expertise in whatever area I was working in. And because I was moved around a lot, I didn't have a lot of expertise in most of those areas. The one area that I was fairly competent in was casting, because as a metallurgist, and I guess I was moved in and out of the cast house about 10 times. But, and you know, I remember when I walked into the maintenance section, it was pretty sad, really. It was a very long corridor with tradespeople on both sides. And as I walked in on my first day at sort of 7 o'clock in the morning, there was a hissing, and there was a hissing as I walked the length of it, which took about 2 or 3 minutes. And I remember thinking, you know, I could turn around here and walk straight out, and I don't think they'd sack me because I would have really just said this is too hard. And when I got to the other end, this guy walked up to me and I thought, I think I'm being set up here. And he dropped a little black box in my hand and he said, Liz, how are you going to fix this? And fortunately, I had just enough reflexes to drop it back in his hands and say, well, I'm not planning on fixing anything like that, and that's why we employ you with your expertise. And there was a bit of laughter, and I thought, well, that didn't go down as badly as I thought it could have. It could have gone down really badly. You know, if I started arguing and I said, look, I'm not here to be an expert tradesperson. I'm here to do a job, which is to manage all of you. And that's a completely different environment to the past, because everyone before had been, you know, the expert senior tradesperson, really. And here's this young female with no expertise in maintenance whatsoever, working with, you know, 50 tradespeople and 50 apprentices. So that was pretty interesting.
You've told a couple of stories that outline how tough it was, or what you were confronted with, I guess, being one of the first women. What made you stay, Liz?
The stimulation of the job. I mean, you're going back to being swapped around all the time. That keeps you pretty well on your toes. I think I was very lucky to be put into research straight after I graduated, because it was an environment that I wasn't expecting to be in, and it certainly was an environment that I wasn't familiar with. But that was a pretty stimulating period for a couple of years. And then I was made plant metallurgist, so I was climbing over roofs and climbing into ball crushers and all sorts of things to sort of get samples. And that, I remember thinking, wow, I don't really ever expect that I would have been doing something like this in my life. And then I started, I had a mentor, and he said, Liz, I'd like you to start running half of the cast house. And I went, gee, I've never run anything like that. I've always been in a technical sort of role. And the first thing I did was, because I didn't know what else to do, I sat down with every one of, I think, my 80 new starters and asked them a few questions. And I took them in the office, made them a cup of coffee, and some of them were shaking like I was going to sack them. And I said, look, no, I just wanted to get to know you. I want to know what it's all about. And I thought afterwards, I didn't know that was the best step I could ever take, but it meant that when I went out and worked with the team, I knew everybody. I knew a little bit about them. I could ask about their kids, their wife, their dog, or their footy team. You had to get good at cricket and footy teams. That sort of thing became just a conversation point, because I didn't have much in common in the beginning, to be honest. And that was extremely, just a good feeling. I remember not thinking, and I hate getting up early in the morning, but I got up early in the morning for 43 years. I don't now. And just thinking, you know, I'm enjoying going to work. I'm enjoying being there. Occasionally I felt fairly proud of a personal achievement or a team achievement or just the way we were running, you know. So there was a whole range of things that keep you going. And I think I'm probably one of the luckiest people in the world to have such a great job.
When you think about some of those proud moments, what do you think was the most satisfying part of your career, or most satisfying chapter of all those different places that you went while you were there?
The hardest ones were probably the most satisfactory ones. For example, running a potline, we had to extend the potline while we were operating. And I don't know if you know much about making aluminium, but you basically have to keep the power on all the time or everything freezes up. And so I remember working with the engineer to sort of have very short off times that we'd then have to get back up and get up and running and sort of working your way through something that sounded to me like it was impossible. But anyway, we did make it happen, and, you know, the $50 million project came through, and that was fantastic. But I remember at the time thinking, no, this is all a bit too hard and I don't know how we'll manage this. And I remember one of the other ones, I was in charge of running the carbon baking furnace. The carbon's the sort of sacrificial part. You have carbon plus aluminium oxide makes basically carbon dioxide and aluminium. And the old plant was falling down. The new plant was being built. We had to decommission the old one and run the new one at the same time and keep the plant running. And I just remember thinking, this is all very hard. I don't know how we're going to make this. You know, it was a sort of $95 million project or something. You had to make it work or the plant shut down. And those sort of stresses are pretty high. And I remember I was there on Christmas Day because we had a conveyor that was jamming, and I was passing not far away to go to family lunch. So I ended up with the family in the car park while I sort of went in and worked with the team to keep the plant running. And those sort of things at the time are a bit stressful. But later on you think, you know, we achieved something there, and I don't know if anyone else, you know, above me on the site had any idea that how close we were to, you know, a major disaster.
Are there any stories that you haven't really talked about publicly before but do capture the heart of what a place like Bell Bay is really like?
I remember when I was moved into the maintenance workshop, which consisted of a lot of boiler makers and welders and fitters and turners and machinists, I was put on a lathe and I went, this looks pretty scary. And one of the interesting things is one of the older guys came up and he said, Liz, I'll be keeping an eye on you and I'll look after you. And just to know someone, you know, that was 30 years, because I would have been 19 probably, and he would have been 55 or 60, just to know there was someone there that cared enough. And the opposite of, you know, you're taking a job away from my son is people have said, you know, don't swear in front of Liz. I wouldn't like that in front of my daughter. So you got the converse of that with some people absolutely understanding that it was fairly difficult. And I'd never comment. People swore at me and about me and around me and wrote all sorts of graffiti on the walls and all those sort of things. And some people would just quietly come and whitewash the wall or I'm just trying to think, you know, just sort of calm down the environment that was completely foreign to me.
You went into this environment that was foreign to you. It then became an enormous part of your life for 43 years. I guess now your life moves at a bit of a different pace, doing the work that you're doing, living in Coles Bay. But I wonder how often you still think about that chapter of your life, Liz.
Oh, quite a lot, yeah. One story I didn't tell you about was my husband and I had been married for 10 years, and we thought if we don't get around to having children, and part of that was because I was working and studying a lot, we'd better get on with it. So I'm 3 months pregnant, and all of a sudden in Australia, maternity leave became a right. And I remember thinking, wow, I think I just waited for the right time. I was 30 by this stage. I just waited for the right time. So I wandered into HR and said, look, I'm pregnant and I'd like to apply the maternity leave policy. And they said, well, we don't have one. And I said, oh, well, I'll help you write it. So we wrote a maternity leave policy for me. And I was not paid or anything like that, but I had a job at the end of it.
Wow, what a legacy, Liz. Oh, we've talked about some big things like a maternity leave policy, making sure that your contract on that very first day wasn't revoked. But what were the small things that turned out to matter more than perhaps you expected?
I think making a bunch of friends. And Jeff Baker's a good example. I worked with Jeff on and off for about 30 years, I think, and he's just a lovely bloke. And you sort of, if you ever wanted a quiet word, he was always that person that you could just wander around and have a bit of a chat to because he's quite chatty and a lovely bloke. But there were many people like that, and it was just lovely to be able to go and bounce things off people to just see what they thought. And some of my bosses were absolutely wonderful to me, Leo Rufo and Bob Harkness, and I'm just trying to think. There were several, Martin Crapper early on in my life, Raymond Stogel, one of the later GMs, and just those sort of people helped. They expected you to make the decision but were more than willing to listen while you sort of had a bit of a think about what to do. And the same with, as I said, all the people that were working the hard roles, they were the people you go and chat to, and quite often they'd say, you know, have you thought about doing this or what about that? That you go home with your day a little bit brighter.
70 years the Smelter's been going for, Liz. It's the anniversary. What do you want to say to people who might be listening to this?
I think Rio Tinto has shaped my life, shaped the life of a lot of people. It's a wonderful organisation. I can remember thinking, how lucky am I, how privileged am I to be able to work in this industry, to survive, mature, thrive over my 43 years. And the whole community, if you think of the Georgetown community, the Tamar Valley community, and probably even part of the Launceston community, is a better place as a result of Rio Tinto.
Liz, I should let you get back to your retirement, I say in quotation marks. Thank you so much for spending time with us today and telling us so many of your stories of your 43 years at Rio Tinto.
Thank you very much.
That's Liz Swain. And Liz, along with Jeff Baker and Heather Ashley, have racked up a lot of years and a lot of memories on site at Bell Bay Aluminium. And next episode, the stories continue, but this time from outside the gate, as we go and get the view from the community.
And that's almost like a gold standard example of how public, private and community can all work together.
We were built back in the 40s and 50s as a fishing village, and then when the Rio turned up...
I love it when... You hear, oh, I've been to a garden on the mainland, but, you know, it wasn't nearly as good as our garden.
They're showing off. I love it.
That's a lot.
I just think we can't do anything alone as a community. Like, you need partnerships. Like, you can't do it alone. It does take a village to raise a child.
Next episode, we'll go into the community and hear how these partnerships and projects work and get a deeper understanding of the impact they've created. My name is Penny Terry, and this is Hotspots, a podcast that gives us a chance to look back on 70 years of stories about the aluminium smelter at Bell Bay.